Hey, it's Craig. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Canadian History X early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Half a century ago, the professional Native Indian Artists Incorporated changed the Canadian art world forever. As Indigenous activism spread across North America in the 1970s, this group of seven First Nation painters formed a collective with the goal of asserting the artistic expressions and self-determination of Indigenous peoples. From their involvement in Expo 67 to their groundbreaking group exhibitions, the influence of Norval Morisseau, Daphne Ojig, Alex Janvier, Carl Ray, Jackson Beardy, Eddie Cobanes, and Joseph Sanchez is still felt to this very day. You've heard about the Group of Seven, but now it's time to learn about the Indigenous Group of Seven. Here's Episode 1 of Among Equals, the history and legacy of the Professional Native Indian Artists Incorporated.
Good evening. Remember his name. It's Norval Morisseau, a 31-year-old Ojibwe painter whose works were publicly displayed for the first time last week. The Toronto art world responded warmly to the showing held at a small gallery in the city's Greenwich Village.
So what are we listening to?
The audio we're listening to is from a segment that appeared on the CBC program Close Up. It's from September 23, 1962.
The collectors had heard the new name and came in droves to see and buy his art. They liked what they saw and snapped up all of his 35 pictures for a total of $4,000. Overnight, Norval Morisseau, the shy, mystical artist, had found the acceptance he always knew would be his.
Wow, so a discovery of a new talent?
The introduction of a seminal figure in contemporary Indigenous art. This is what you call a watershed moment in history. In September 1962, Norval Morisseau had his first solo exhibition in Toronto's Pollock Gallery.
A lot of people try to do art. A lot of people study to do art. And then there's a select rare few individuals that, you know, the Great Spirit puts on this planet to give us art. And Morisseau was one of them.
This is Corey Dingle.
I am Corey Dingle. I run the estate of Norval Morisseau.
This exhibition was the first of its kind in Canada. It was organized by Jack Pollock, who was himself an artist, but also an art dealer and gallery owner.
Morris was kind of emergence on the art scene. One, it was an art gallery. It was a commercial art gallery.
This is Greg Hill.
My name's Greg A. Hill. I'm an artist, a curator, and an Indigenous art consultant.
Greg also wrote Norval Morisseau, a book that covers 50 years of the artist's life and work.
It was work that really no one was familiar with. No one had seen that kind of imagery before.
At least no one who was dealing in arts in Canada at the time.
So it was coming from a place, an unknown place, you know, and Jack Pollock felt like he was making a grand discovery in bringing this artist, you know, out of the wilderness to the city.
We also have to remember at that time that Norval was dealing with absolute systemic racism. The savage bush Indian, who were degraded in the eyes of the modern culture.
At the time, Indigenous art was not seen as art. It was the domain of anthropologists and ethnographers, not gallerists or even art critics.
Right.
You have to remember that human zoos were still in living memory. Just 80 years ago, you could go to the Jardin d'Acclimation in Paris and see Abraham Ulricab, an Inukman from Northern Labrador, and his family on exhibit in an enclosure. And still, 16 years after that, a group from Sioux Nation lived in a village on the grounds of the Cincinnati Zoo. Indigenous bodies were the subject of exhibitions. So the concept of us as artists, well, this was a radical new idea for non-Indigenous audiences.
We weren't considered professional, and we weren't really considered artists. We were considered craft people. It was always considered less, and it was also valued less.
Joseph M. Sanchez.
I'm the founding member of Professional Native Indian Artists, Inc. What are the original seven?
Joseph was the youngest member of the Indigenous group of seven. He has helped us immensely with this podcast.
Moxins and mukluks weren't considered at all art. Today, I consider some of that stuff really fine art because of the kind of craftsmanship and dedication and spirit that's put into some of these objects. And in a sense, you know, the culture of Native America was always, you know, something that could be sold. And people wanted that culture. They wanted the objects. They wanted the symbols, but they didn't want the people. And that's something that we really were fighting against in the formation of this group. And also, basically, the world art system, which didn't consider work by Indigenous people artwork. You know, these were artifacts. They could be special. They could be very artistic, but they were still artifacts.
If I talk about that 60s moment, and there's a famous picture of that Norval at that show, and he's just standing, just iron spine rod straight up, and he's looking at the camera with firm determination in front of his work. And there's a little lady off to the side looking up to him and going, who is it? Like, what? Who is this person? And she's fascinated by what she's seeing from a spectator point of view.
He's on display.
This brings us back to the show at the Pollock Gallery. This is Norval talking to June Calwood as part of that segment on close-up.
One of the things that we were wondering about is how you were feeling when the gallery show opened. The people came in and looked at your paintings.
And it felt nothing.
Nothing? Did you feel strange about them?
Well, in a way, I was a little strange.
Did you feel that they were judging you?
Why is she talking to him like he's six?
That's going to be a theme, unfortunately.
Do you think that they understood what you were trying to say with the paintings?
I hope so, that they understood me.
This week, I understand you made $4,000. What are you going to do with that?
I don't know.
What have you wanted?
What I wanted was people to know this art. This is all I ever wanted. But I don't like to be honored. I don't want everybody to think, well, here's Norval Morris, or the great medicine man or artist. I don't want them to think that they're me. I want them just to think as I am.
And what are you?
An Indian. An Indian among Indians. Same thing, like, I don't like to think the artist to think me as a great artist. Like, you're an artist and I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. Not because I made $4,000 this week, I'm greater than you when you made $200 last week. It's this way. To be equal, that's what I like.
End of cold open. Time to do the intro.
Right. I'm Ryan Barnett, and this is episode one in our new series, Among Equals, the history and legacy of the Professional Native Indian Artists Incorporated. This is a special presentation of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood North, hosted by
Soleil Lunière.
So what is the Professional Native Indian Artists Incorporated?
The PNIAI, or the Indian Group of Seven, as they were called by the press, was a collective of Indigenous artists who, in the early 1970s, exhibited together.
That was all or nothing. We're representing all our people.
To raise the profile of Indigenous art.
That was really a rock star moment for me.
And created a permanent space in galleries for Indigenous artists in Canada and around the world.
They resisted colonial discourse, and they wanted to break with identity definitions and boundaries placed on First Nations people.
But there had been a screen in front of them that prevented people from really discerning who they were. And that hole that they made, that they pierced through that screen, has stayed open.
Can't wait to hear the whole story.
But first, a break.
Okay, so who were the other members of the Professional Native Indian Artists Incorporated?
There was Carl Ray.
Carl was a great artist. Carl taught art in remote communities, but Carl was also a great realistic artist.
Eddie Kobinas.
I love Eddie's renditions of wildlife, and I particularly so when he goes away from the realistic and gets more into like the Kobinas style, which is, you know, closer to like the second generation of woodland style.
Jackson Beardy.
He represented his people well. He was able to break barriers and he was able to make changes to the concept of native people.
Alex Janvier.
I think he's maybe most of all an observer of nature and light, always kind of commenting on the quality of light in different places.
Daphne Ojig.
She's an amazing, amazing individual. Brilliant, I would say. You know, just scary smart. When she began to illustrate the tales of the elders, she began to develop a style that is now quite iconic.
And Joseph Sanchez.
Working with all these artists has been my education in the art world. My main mentors to date are Daphne Ojig, who allowed me to work in her studio in those early days and mine her library of art books, and the founder of the Phoenix Art Museum. His name was Philip C. Curtis, and he was described as a Victorian surrealist.
So that's the Magnificent Seven?
That's them.
So where do we start?
We start with Morisseau.
If I start at the very origin of Morisseau, I would say that he was a natural-born painter. He was a rare individual where it seemed the timing of the earth was transferring from a menagerie of past and present. And he seemed to be holding on to, with one hand, the past and in the other hand, grasping the present. When we look at Morisseau's early beginnings, we see this beginning of an individual who is going to have to walk two paths between two different worlds.
Norval was raised in Sandpoint along the southeast shore of Lake Nipigon. He was indeed raised in two worlds. He was raised by his maternal grandparents. His grandfather was a shaman and taught Norval Anishinaabe culture and spirituality, while his grandmother taught him about Catholicism.
He would say, we lived in the bush.
But because this was Canada in the 1930s...
Very early on, he was quite forcibly taken away from that environment and put into a residential school where he suffered the same trials and tribulations that many of them did.
At six, Norval was put in St. Joseph's Indian Residential School in Fort William, Ontario.
His first day, he went into the residential school and he had to use the bathroom. And so a father brought him into the bathroom area, and there was these white devices on the wall, and he saw another boy urinating in this white device, which we would know as a urinal now, but Norval had never seen anything like that. And he went up and started urinating in the same urinal as the boy, and the father proceeded to whip him for it. And so that was his, you know, first day at school.
Norval continued to experience abuse, both physical and sexual, while at St. Joseph's, and he ran away a lot.
We have police records, actually, of him repeatedly running away from the residential school and being caught by the RCMP and brought back, but one final time, they did not.
You had how much education?
Grade 4.
You know, a little bit later on, there was quite obviously a systemic racism in a number of the towns where they even had civil laws that an Indigenous person couldn't come into the town. And so Morisseau's origin of dealing with another society, you know, he was allowed to go to the church. You were allowed to go to the you know, to the mill to work, or you could go to the garbage dump, and that was about it. So when we look at entities that directly affected him, you know, from an early standpoint, you see these three elements being quite significant.
Church, the mill, and the dump.
Especially the garbage dump, unfortunately.
At 18 or 19, Morisseau fell gravely ill.
He thought he was dying.
But as Norval would tell it, he was
visited by, you know, some entities and told him that they weren't really done with him yet, that they needed him to do something. And they told him that he needed to, you know, paint these oral traditions of his people, or that they would be lost forever to time. And at that point in time, it was taboo to do so. He got better. He started to paint the traditions that he knew from listening to, you know, his elders and especially his grandfather. And he was ostracized for doing it.
Norval wrote about this himself. In his essay, My Name is Norval Morisseau, he writes, "The Ojibwe people were very unhappy about me showing tribal secrets to the white people. There is what some people call a taboo, and a taboo is hard to break. But my grandfather said, go ahead. He was a rebel himself. He knew eventually something was going to happen. Something had to happen. But it had to be the personal choice of the individual, because, after all, you are dealing with the supernatural."
I always say I was born with a paintbrush in my hand, because it just seems that I've been doing it forever.
This is Daphne Ojig in an interview she did for the McMichael Gallery 14 years ago.
And my grandfather was a great artist. He made tombstones, and I followed him all over. Since I was the firstborn, I was his little shadow.
Daphne Ojig was born in 1919 on Witwemikon unceded territory, Manitoulin Island.
Her dad was a member of Witwemikon First Nation.
This is Bonnie Devine.
My name is Bonnie Devine. I'm a visual artist. I do some writing. I've done some curating. I am a off-reserve member of the Serpent River First Nation, which is an Anishinaabe territory on the north shore of Lake Huron. Dominic Ojig, that was Daphne's dad. He had served in the First World War in Europe. And in Europe, he met Daphne's mother.
Joyce Peachy, an English bride.
And she traveled back to Witwemikon at the end of the war.
Daphne was Joyce and Dominic's firstborn. She grew up on a farm and had a pet lamb named Molly, who was allowed in the house. As she's described in her autobiography, Molly's hard little hoof sounded like ladies walking in high heels. She attended the Jesuit-run school and early on decided that teaching would be her life's work.
She started a little play school in which, of course, she was the teacher, the headmistress, and the main disciplinarian. And so she would teach her younger brothers and sister and the neighbor children their numbers, their ABCs, how to read. She had them, you know, when the younger brother went to school, he already knew his times table and everything. So she was very, very interested in an early age, or from an early age, in education.
This will be important later.
Okay.
She was always a precocious artist and would exchange services with her fellow students, drawing in exchange for help for an arithmetic problem or composition. While math and writing were not her strong suit, Friday afternoons meant art class. In that class, they learned watercolors. "I can remember this distinctly," Daphne recounts in her autobiography, Paintbrush in My Hand. She says, "I remember the teacher saying, you draw that tree as you see it, and you draw the tree, not how you feel about it." Daphne was a little girl seeking self-expression. At 13, Daphne fell ill with rheumatic fever, the same disease that had weakened her mother's heart as a child. Joyce was terrified for her daughter, and as a result, Daphne was put on enforced rest for 3 years.
Enforced rest?
She spent her days in bed, or not far from it. She had to watch as her siblings went to school, something she loved. But in that time, she grew even closer to her grandfather.
Jonas Ojig was the stone carver for the village. So he was engaged in carving the gravestones, among other things. So he had considerable skills in terms of designing, filling up a two-dimensional space with three-dimensional form as relief carving.
Tell me a little bit more about your grandfather, because he seemed to loom fairly large in your childhood.
This is from a 1992 interview with the CBC.
Yes, he played an important role in my life. He was a tombstone carver, and I would watch him chipping out the stone. And I sat with him many hours on the porch sketching.
This is something they shared for years together. Again, from her book, Daphne delighted in sharing the creative process with a kindred soul.
You know, her artwork, the way that she made marks on paper, really reflects this notion of carving. So very curvilinear forms, a kind of etched line that she was very interested in emulating, I think probably learned from her granddad.
So by all accounts, she had a relatively happy childhood?
Yes, but things changed when Joyce died. Daphne was 18.
And Daphne and her sister Winnie left the island and went to Parry Sound, quite a distance away, actually, ostensibly to find work and to try to, form their own little household.
For Daphne, who rarely left Wiki, she was suddenly faced with racism on a daily basis.
You know, she speaks about seeking work in the community. She sought work as a domestic. Her education, her formal education, had been truncated because of the illness. So she had a little bit of a disadvantage in that sense. So the work that she sought was domestic work, cleaning people's houses, dishwashing. As soon as they heard her last name, the door would be closed. So there were no employment opportunities.
Like Novel, she found herself between two worlds. For the first time in her life, she was confronted by her own indigeneity, even in her own household. Her maternal grandmother, who herself married a First Nation man later in life, resented being the butt of gossip among the white community of Parry Sound. Daphne and her sister Winnie were aware of the embarrassment their uncles and cousins felt having Indians in the family. The girls' black hair and dark complexions were topics of conversation. Their uncles called them dirty little s**t, and Winnie's grandmother called her little p**t, itself a racist term for a black child.
But what about her art?
Well, Grandpa Copagog, the husband of her grandmother, supported her creative life during this time. He built her a work table, a tilting draft table with a little bar at the bottom to hold her paper. So after her long work days, Daphne would sit at this table and draw or paint for hours. She would take Grandpa Copagog's old cigar boxes, decorated them with painted flowers and patterns, and give them to her family as Christmas gifts. But when she did this, she signed her work Fisher.
Ojig means fisher in Ojibwa. It's the fisher, of course, is a small river animal.
And she signed her work Daphne Fisher, or sometimes just Daphne. In fact, she did this for decades, only resuming the use of Ojig in the 1960s.
Would you describe for us something that's in one of your paintings, say the big colored one of the bird and the what seems to be a snake?
We're still in 1962 at the Pollock Gallery.
Yep, this is Norval talking to June Calwood.
Well, the picture represents a thunderbird. And these are lightning marks, the ones that are shooting forth from its eyes. And then the lightning marks, or the lightning, goes on top of its head, the snake's head, to paralyze it. And these, the tail square mark on the tail, these are medicine symbols. It represents any medicine here, what the Indians know. And of course, the claw marks where the blood
What are the sort of patterns on the snake and on the bird?
Well, we could say the scales were there. And those little marks there on the Thunderbird, I thought I would put them on there because they look so sacred to me.
Do they look sacred?
Yes.
Before that, indigenous art wasn't really looked at as an area of art, even though we disagree now with that concept. But it was completely, it didn't really exist. If it did, it was you bought something at a train from somebody holding something up for a nickel, right? It wasn't conceived as a expression of a culture.
That's Corey Dingle again.
When we talk about advancing Canadian understanding, our moral and ethical spirituality advancement, Morisseau was absolutely imperative, a towering figure on bringing that forward into Canada's mind and saying, deal with it. You know, you're going to have to deal with this.
So the significance of him and that Pollock show in 1962 was it was like an explosion.
This is Greg Hill.
In terms of its emergence, its reception by critics, not knowing anything about something and then, you know, feeling the raw power of his work and that it was something very fresh, something unknown, and realizing that there might be more, and for sure there was more so was the tip of an iceberg, really.
Because before Morisseau, nobody painted like this in this form. They gave us a new perspective for humanity, and taking bits from everywhere. People see stained glass windows from the church that he was only allowed to look at in his art. They see 1960 comic books that he picked up out of the garbage bin. They see, you know, ancient pictographic forms that he saw, you know, carved into the rocks around the area that he was in. And I'm not saying that these are the true origins, but this is what people interpret when they try to define where did these visions come from.
I think it was November 62 in Weekender magazine, which was this great little magazine that would come out across Canada. And it was our only, you know, sort of splashy color magazine that we ever saw. And there was a big inset on Morisseau in 1962 after his exhibition. And it compared him to Picasso at the time. And I think the comparison to Picasso is useful in that Morisseau created a new visual language for the world, and so did Picasso. But I don't really like that label.
This is Carmen Robertson.
My name is Carmen Robertson, and I'm a Scots Lakota researcher, and I'm the Canada Research Chair in North American Indigenous Art and Material Culture at Carleton as well.
Dr. Robertson wrote a book about Norval.
In 2016, I published two books on Norval. One is a digital book through the Art Canada Institute that's really geared at more of a non-academic audience to learn about his art and life. And then the other is Mythologizing Norval Morisseau. And that is a more traditional academic book, but it allowed me to go far deeper into thinking about sort of the colonial landscape around Morisseau and what he came out of as an Indigenous artist. And so when Morisseau entered the scene in 62, Indigenous man, it was difficult for art critics to think about how to capture this new artist on the scene. So although there was some, potentially critically positive review of his art by some art critics in newspapers, for the most part, Morisot was stuck within this stereotypical lens of what it meant to be an Indigenous man in the 1960s.
The same article with the same details was written and published about Norval in the wake of that first exhibition. He was untrained. The generous articles described him as self-taught. He was discovered in the bush by Alistair Grossart, or was it Selwyn Dewdney or Jack Pollock? He was willing to sell his paintings for $5 when Jack Pollock proposed an exhibition. He was stirred by nature and the legend of his people. An article appearing in Time magazine declared, "Few exhibits in Canadian art history have touched off a greater immediate stir than Morisot's." The Toronto critics approved unanimously and speculated that self-taught Morisot may have launched a vogue as chic as the Cape Dorset Eskimo prince. But almost as soon as Norval began interacting with the press, he learned to play the game, working the media and the market. On the next episode of Among Equals, we look at Indigenous artists in Expo 67.
That was a watershed moment. It was really the first time that Indians in Canada had a voice in an international forum. There's this story that gets repeated about the Queen going through the pavilion and leaving ashen-faced, not anticipating what she was going to be seeing in there.
Among Equals is a special presentation of Knockabout Media and has been made possible by the Government of Canada. It's hosted by me, Soleil Lounière, and produced by Ryan Barnett, Maya Foster-Sanchez, and Naka Bertrand. Our series advisors are Joseph M. Sanchez and Donna Filedichuk. This series features interviews with Bonnie Devine, Greg A. Hill, Michelle Lavallée, Carmen Robertson, Pauline Beardy, Philip Gavick, Corey Dingle, Donna Filedichuk, and Joseph M. Sanchez. Special thanks to Eric Berendt at the Indigenous Arts Center. Our series artwork is by Caleb Ellison Dysart, with additional work by Carlene Harvey. For a list of sources used in this series and to download the listening guide, visit knockaboutmedia.com.
A Knockabout Media original. Hold on.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.